We've made it through the whole process. We just finished cellular respiration when I stopped last time. This is actually a recap of the big payoff in cellular respiration. This shows both parts of oxidative phosphorylation, which hopefully you know by now are electron transport and chemiosmosis. So you can see just one of the many copies of electron transport chains here, one of many copies of an ATP synthase molecule beside it. There's both, they're both embedded in the same inner membrane of the mitochondrion. The usable energy, that meaning the energy that has not been wasted as heat so far and that has not already been put into the form of ATP, is currently in the form of reduced coenzymes that were made in previous parts in the process. NADH and H plus was produced in glycolysis. NADH and H plus was produced in the oxidative carboxylation of pyruvate. NADH and H plus was produced in the citric acid cycle. And FADH2 was produced in the citric acid cycle. All of those full taxis are carrying what's left of the usable energy that has not been put into ATP form yet. And so that's why they all drive their passengers, those electrons and protons from the fuel originally, to the electron transport chain. And NADH and H+, or NAD taxi, is able to drop its cargo off at the first member of the chain, whereas FADH2 has to drop it off at the second member, but they both drop electrons off, and electrons get passed from one member to the next. That allows for a little bit of release of energy at a time. Some will be wasted as heat, but where does the rest of that energy go into as electrons are transported? Because electron transport uses that remaining available energy that's being carried by those taxis. So what does that accomplish? No ATP is produced here at electron transport. Okay, you are not ready for this upcoming test, which is the hardest one. Cannot put it off until the last night. What does electron transport actually accomplish? Is the cell just trying to get electrons to a different place? No. There's a purpose behind this. Yes. Release of energy by electron transport accomplishes a storage of energy in a different form, right? Before this, the usable energy was in the form of the reduced coenzymes, the full taxis. After electron transport, the usable energy is now in the form of a proton gradient that was established because three of these members of the electron transport chain operate as pumps to pump protons from the matrix through the inner mitochondrial membrane to the intermembrane space. Okay, you have no more fuel left, you have no more reduced coenzymes left, but you'd still have usable energy in the form of the proton gradient itself. That's what electron transport by itself accomplishes. And then the final part of the final part, part two of oxidative phosphorylation, which is chemiosmosis, employs that proton gradient. The gradient means that the protons would like to diffuse down that gradient. In other words, they would like to go back through the membrane into the matrix from where they were pumped out of. But they are positively charged particles and therefore cannot easily get through the phospholipid bilayer. And that's why it's a payoff, because the only places that they're able to get back through and into the matrix is through the copies of ATP synthase. And that is a payoff because that diffusion of protons through the ATP synthase molecules spins the rotors, deforms the catalytic knobs, allows those catalytic knobs to act as enzymes to stick an inorganic phosphate onto an ADP one at a time to produce ATP. That's this step right here. And that's how most of the ATP that gets produced from the energy that's in one glucose molecule originally gets produced. Over 90% of the ATP that a glucose can produce, that the energy in glucose can produce, is produced in this final step. You just get a little bit earlier on when you do it via substrate level phosphorylation in glycolysis and citric acid cycle. So this will continue to happen as long as what is true. What is required for oxidative phosphorylation to continue? Right. Electron transport itself, which is part of oxidative phosphorylation, can only occur for as long as something at the end of the electron transport chain can accept those electrons to keep the electron transport chain itself from filling up with electrons. It will come to a halt if you don't have something taking those electrons at the end. And what is it that does that? Oxygen for most things, including us. Any respiring organism has to have a final electron acceptor. And for organisms that employ the aerobic method of respiration, which is us, then that final electron acceptor is oxygen. In species that don't use oxygen, they still have to use something else. Because if you don't have some electron final electron acceptor, then the electrons will fill up the chain, and that will mean no more pumping of protons, which means eventually, once the gradient gets dissipated, so there is no difference in concentration between the intermembrane space and the matrix, there's no more tendency for them to diffuse, and therefore they're not going to turn the rotors. That will shut down ATP production, right? But it also is a problem because now all the full taxis that have been reduced in the previous steps won't have electron transport chains to dump their electrons onto if they fill up. So it all really depends on that final electron acceptor allowing things to continue. If it's not available, then you have to have another method for that to happen. But first, and that other method is fermentation. First, though, let's look at the overall summary. That previous one was a summary of just oxidative phosphorylation, which is part three of cellular respiration. This is a summary of the entire process. And it looks very similar to a slide we started with before we started talking about the process. Keep in mind that the overall complete oxidation of glucose is a two-part process. Glycolysis is the first part. That happens out in the cytoplasm. I mean, in the cytosol, the liquid component of the cytoplasm. That produces a little bit of ATP by substrate-level phosphorylation, but not much. These are per-glucose numbers. But glycolysis is what gets the splitting of the fuel going. It splits it into two pyruvates, remember. That ATP that's produced is useful, of course, but actually more energy than that is stored in the fact that you reduce two NAD pluses into NADH and H plus. So that's carrying a bunch of energy, but so is pyruvate, which is only partially spent fuel. So the second part of the overall process is cellular respiration itself, which has three parts to it. What's this first one represented by the white arrow? First part of cellular respiration?
Oxidative decarboxylation.
Of what?
Pyruvate.
Right. The oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate breaks the fuel down a little bit more. Decarboxylation means it takes a CO2 off of it, so CO2 is produced there. It also, though, gets you some more useful energy in the form of more NADH and H+. And it doesn't complete the breakdown of the fuel because you still have two identical carbon compounds left over that are valuable fuel still, right? What are those? What's left of the fuel after the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate? Right. You have two of them because you have two pyruvates entering for each glucose, right? One glucose gets split into two pyruvates. When you take the carbon dioxide off of the pyruvate, you have acetyl, which gets picked up by coenzyme A. While it's riding in coenzyme A, the whole thing is called acetyl coenzyme A. Coenzyme A drives it to the next part of cellular respiration, which is the citric acid cycle, drops the acetyl off, and then the coenzyme A is emptied and can go back and pick more up. But the two-carbon fuel, that acetyl group that gets delivered to the citric acid cycle, then is broken down the rest of the way. So that's where the rest of the CO2 comes out, and citric acid cycle therefore completes the dismantling of the carbon skeleton. You have no more fuel left, but you've made some more ATP by substrate level phosphorylation in the citric acid cycle. That's valuable. Even more importantly, you make a bunch more NADH and H+, as well as some FADH2, more full taxis. So all of these places where the taxis are filled are valuable because the final payoff is for those taxis to deliver those electrons and protons to the electron transport chain. The protons don't go down the chain, the electrons do, but that allows for the pumping of the protons to establish the gradient, which then pays off in the form of chemiosmosis, which spins the rotors, producing the vast majority of the ATP that's produced in this whole process. All right? Glycolysis does not require oxygen. Of course, electron transport does, as we said. But if oxygen's not there, as I was saying, the electron transport chain is going to fill up. So that's going to stop further production of ATP by cellular respiration. It's going to stop step 3, right? Oxidative phosphorylation, because that's where electron transport chain is. But it's also going to back everything else up, because not only does the electron transport chain not continue to operate when it fills up, it means that the taxis can't dump their electrons onto the electron transport chains. So if it weren't for an alternative process, even glycolysis, which does not directly require oxygen, would stop in the absence of oxygen. And that would kill the cell, of course, and therefore the organism. So there has to be a different way for glycolysis to occur when the final electron acceptor, oxygen in our case, is not present. Why is it that glycolysis would shut down? What requirement of glycolysis would not be met if you didn't have a final electron acceptor? Well, what are the inputs? What are the three inputs into glycolysis?
Glucose, NAD+, ATP.
Okay. Which of those would not be there if you didn't have oxygen taking the electrons off of the chain at the other end? What did I just say would happen? Without oxygen, the electron transport chains would fill up. And what else? If they filled up, what is the big deal about that?
stop line?
Yes. Everything downstream of that stops. But what else? What about upstream? Which of the what did you say are the three component the three inputs into glycolysis?
Glucose.
Okay, now is glucose going to be affected? Yes, why? NAD plus is oxidized, which is what is required for glycolysis. Why would that be a problem without oxygen? Why couldn't it? What normally oxidizes NADH and H+? How does NADH normally get reconverted into NAD+? Yes. And if the electron transport chains are full, they can't do that. The taxis can't get rid of their passengers. That's why glycolysis would stop. Because you have to have NAD plus, not NADH, for glycolysis to happen. Glycolysis relies on NAD plus taking the electrons from the fuel to make it into NADH. That's why it would stop. All right? So, in the absence of the final electron acceptor, in the absence of oxygen, there has to be some other way to re-oxidize the coenzymes, to re-oxidize NADH back into NAD+, so that glycolysis can continue to make the 2-ATP that it makes. It's not nearly as efficient, but at least the cell won't die. That process, as we transition to slide 21, is fermentation. That's what fermentation is for. Fermentation by itself does not produce any ATP. It's glycolysis that's producing the ATP. But a cell doesn't need fermentation if cellular respiration is possible, which it will be as long as you have the final electron acceptor available. And that's because NADHs will just dump their electrons onto the electron transport chain, and that's how they become reoxidized. They can then drive back to glycolysis and pick up more, allowing glycolysis to happen. But if cellular respiration has stopped because you don't have anything unloading those electron transport chains, then fermentation is the way to get NADH back into NAD+, to reoxidize it. And any given species has one method of fermentation that it uses, but there are many different versions of fermentation that have evolved in different species, even though most biology textbooks only mention two. The reason it mentions two is because one of them is very valuable to us as an industrial process. This is how we make beer and wine and cheese and bread. And the other one is mentioned because it's the kind that our own bodies do. But these are not the only kind of fermentation methods that occur. There are two that are shown here, though, are alcohol fermentation and lactic acid fermentation. The particulars are really not... let me start that over. Alcohol fermentation produces alcohol, but that's not what the cell is actually trying to do. It just has to as a way to do what it has to do, which is to reoxidize NADH back into NAD+. That's what fermentation is for. Not to produce this end product, but to reoxidize NADH, which would normally be reoxidized by dumping its electrons off to a cellular respiration. So you have NAD+ available, allowing glycolysis to continue. Well, in alcohol fermenters, yeast, for instance, the pyruvate that's produced from glycolysis, which is, of course, a 3-carbon compound, gets decarboxylated into acetaldehyde. Acetaldehyde, I mean. But in the process, that decarboxylation produces CO2. That acetaldehyde then gets transformed into ethanol, and that's the step that reoxidizes the taxi. Now, this is why when you employ these yeast to make beer for you, it's not only alcoholic, but it's carbonated, because the CO2 gets released. We don't do that in our own cells. Otherwise, we could just hold our breath to get drunk. We produce alcohol that way. But we do it a little bit more directly. Instead of decarboxylating the pyruvate, which would interfere with our acid-base balance, we directly convert the pyruvate into lactate, or lactic acid. That accomplishes the same thing. Reoxidizes the coenzyme so that glycolysis can continue to happen. But notice that it's glycolysis, not fermentation, that is producing the ATP. It's just that if fermentation isn't there as a backup mechanism, then glycolysis will come to a halt, and that would be death. So you can see in 22 that glycolysis happens regardless of whether there is final electron acceptor available or not. So for us, oxygen. If oxygen is there, it definitely is worth it for the cell to take this part in the fork in the road. In other words, to further process pyruvate via cellular respiration, you get a hell of a lot more ATP per glucose that way. But if O2 is not present, that doesn't mean that glycolysis will shut down, because you can then go to fermentation to continue the glycolysis. You just don't make very much ATP. And the cell, of course, doesn't have to actually think about this and make a decision. It will automatically switch to fermentation in the absence of oxygen, simply because that's the only way that the taxis can be emptied. Right? If oxygen's present, they'll just continuously be dumping onto the electron transport chains, and that's what reoxidizes the coenzyme. It will automatically switch to the only way possible if the oxygen is not available. 23. Now, the overall process that we've looked at in this chapter, the complete oxidation of glucose, is written kind of in flowchart form here. That is the central metabolic process. But although glucose is the master fuel, the fuel used most often in all cells, it's not the only possible fuel. For instance, it's only one of several monosaccharides that can be used as fuel. As far as nutrient classes are concerned, you have proteins, carbohydrates, and fats. Carbohydrates can be either big or small, right? So if you're talking about starch, for instance, that you've eaten, the first job is that you have to break that down into individual glucoses. That occurs outside of the body by digestion. But glucose will go, of course, through all the steps we've just talked about. There are other kinds of monosaccharides, though, besides glucose. And those can be fed later into the overall process. Skip a few steps, basically, and they are intermediates. I told you you didn't have to memorize all those intermediates, but those intermediates, some of those things are found in food. Those actually go into a little bit later in the process. Fats, remember, are triglycerides. So there's really four parts to each individual fat. There's a glycerol, and there's three fatty acids. So when it gets digested, those are the four fuel sources you have. Three fatty acids, which might be the same or could be different from each other. Well, they can feed into... Well, let me do glycerol first. Glycerol is a component of glycolysis, so it can just feed right into glycolysis and continue there. Once you get to that point, the cell can't tell whether it came from glucose or some other source. But the fatty acids, if you think back to what a fatty acid is, it's just a carboxyl group with a bunch of hydrocarbons. I mean, a hydrocarbon tail, right? Just C's and H's. Well, remember that it's a two-carbon fuel, the acetyl group, that gets picked up by coenzyme A, right? Two carbons and hydrogens. A fatty acid is many carbons and hydrogens, but if you take the end of it off, two carbons at a time, that's also an acetyl group. So the fatty acids get broken down into acetyls and get fed right into the citric acid cycle, skipping glycolysis, in other words. And so everything happens the same beyond that. Proteins are not really used as fuel nearly as often. And people typically, well, they've been convinced by media that they need a lot of protein, but actually there's a link to cancer with too much protein. Protein is not used for fuel primarily. It's really used for building structures up. So we're recycling our proteins mostly for structural reasons, but we can use it as a fuel if we have to. For instance, when starving, that's what we'll have to because we're out of the other fuels. But the problem with proteins, of course, is that they're made out of amino acids. So the digestion first would break it into amino acids. Amino acids would be the fuels. The problem with an amino acid, though, is that it has that amino group. Carbohydrates and fats don't have any nitrogen, but proteins, amino acids do. Every amino acid has an amino group, of course. That's why it's named that. And therefore, you have to get rid of that nitrogen as nitrogenous waste in the form of ammonia, which in us then gets converted into urea and becomes part of urine. But the rest of it is just carbons, hydrogens, and oxygen, so it can be used as fuel. And depending on which amino acid it is, it can be fed into any of several different places along this central pathway. Okay, so we studied it from the viewpoint of glucose, but all the other kinds of fuels use this central pathway as well, just starting at different points. TGC-24 is the same central pathway, but now what we're looking at is control of it. The central pathway, like any pathway, should be regulated. It's never the case that a cell would want to have all of its pathways running all of the time. It needs to turn things on and turn things off. So that's why you have these red inhibitory feedback loops here. If citrate starts to build up, that is a signal to the cell, you're running this pathway too fast. You're producing more ATP than you actually are demanding by using it. So citrate will feed back into an important enzyme in glycolysis called phosphofructokinase. It's just one of the enzyme, there's an enzyme at every step of the 10-step process, but phosphofructokinase is a control point, and it inhibits it. So you can shut down glycolysis, and of course everything else after that will shut down as well. This, we talked about feedback inhibition already. ATP, when you know you have adenosine nucleotides, that's just a general way of saying ATP or ADP or AMP, right? You have the adenosine fleet of taxis. Well, I shouldn't call those taxis because they're the goal, but they're energy storing molecules. And when you have almost all of them in the form of ATP, that also tells the cell there's no reason you need to do this so fast. We have plenty of energy already. So ATP itself will feed back and shut it down. But if you're not running the pathway fast enough because you are exercising to the point that you're using more ATP than you're producing, then eventually, gradually, your ratio of ATP to ADP to AMP starts to change. And if a bunch of your nucleotides get turned into the AMP form, which is a very low balance, that stimulates phosphofructokinase. That is a strong signal to the cell saying you're not keeping up with demand. So that will not only turn the pathway on, but turn it on quickly so that those AMPs get recharged into ATP and you get back to a normal ratio. It meets demand, in other words. All right, that's that chapter. Let's go to the final one.